Some good news from the housing market.
And what it means for a possible recovery.
From APM, American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org for Tuesday, March 20th.
Coming up, Nielsen launches a new service to keep track of all the places we're seeing ads.
What Mitt Romney and French President Nicolas Sarkozy have in common.
And later, why a hike in gas prices could put the brakes on Chinese economic growth. You'll hear about it all on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The number of new homes builders broke ground on fell last month, according to a report from the Census Bureau, but building permits rose to their highest level since 2008. Here to break this down for us is Michelle Meyer, senior economist at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning.
So, Michelle, what is your takeaway on this news?
I think it's pretty much showing that there's signs of life and recovery in the housing market. It's just happening very slowly. So housing construction is off of the lows, but it's happening at a very slow and bumpy pace.
Michelle, a lot of the new homes being built right now are multifamily, which means they'll probably end up being rental homes. What does that tell us about the market?
I think that's actually the most crucial takeaway of some of the statistics that we're seeing right now. There's a changing dynamic in the housing market where people are shifting from homeownership to renting, in part because of all the foreclosures that are transitioning people out of homeownership, and there's simply not enough rental supply in the market. And that's helped to generate an increase in multifamily construction, which is being built for rental purposes. Rent prices are increasing. Developers are doing quite well by building multifamily construction, and this is a trend that I think will persist.
We've been hearing that there's a big backlog of homes to be purchased, both on the market and that the banks are sitting on. Once those start selling, could we possibly see a slowdown in construction again?
The foreclosures that are sitting on the market are mostly single-family homes, so they're not going to be good substitutes for a multifamily building. So I think the upside to multifamily construction will continue, but the backlog will limit the recovery.
Michelle Meyer is an economist with Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Thank you, Michelle.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Well, let's get some more now on the housing story. And here are the numbers that we're dealing with. Housing starts fell about 1% last month, but they're up 34% from a year ago. And building permits for future homes were up about 5% from January to February. Julie Niemann is an analyst with Smith Moore & Company, and she's with us now from St. Louis to discuss. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So is the housing market rebounding, or is this just another false start?
Oh, it has. The housing spring really has sprung here. Starts slipped a bit, but the January numbers were revised upward. Good winter weather and an economy that isn't getting worse is actually sparking a little optimism here. There really is pent-up demand for housing. You know, we have a larger population, and we've had four rotten years of housing, and it looks like not only is it stabilizing, but beginning to tick up. Permits for construction are the real bellwether here.
And those are up. And Julie, what about people whose houses are worth a lot less than they were several years ago? Should this news be an indication that their situation is about to get better?
Well, in some areas like the Sand States, you're not going to get back to where you were, Florida, Arizona, Nevada, California, because they were at silly prices anyway. What you're seeing stabilization is through the Midwest and through the Northeast. Those are going to recover to pre-crash lengths and heights. It's going to take a while to get there, but at least it's to the point where banks will now loan on the properties. They want to see a stabilization in housing prices, not plunging. That's the positive side.
Now, Julie, one thing that's been affecting just about everything in the economy has been the quick rise in oil prices. Could that have an effect on the housing market?
Not really. The key to oil prices is it hits consumer confidence, and that has a big effect on buying other things. Consumers will be spending less to spending smarter. They're on budgets. When oil prices are flat, they'll indulge a bit. They'll buy other things. You know, they'll go to restaurants, entertainment, clothing, consumer goods. That's what the oil price is going to hit. Not so much housing, because that's more related to jobs, and the jobless situation is beginning to improve somewhat here. So that's the good news.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company. Thanks, as always.
You bet.
The Obama administration may put off tighter pollution rules for gasoline. The Environmental Protection Agency isn't confirming it, but both environmentalists and industry players suspect the agency's holding off because of election year politics, Sarah Gardner reports.
The new rules would force refiners to cut the sulfur content of gasoline. That would make for cleaner car emissions and less smog, says Frank O'Donnell at Clean Air Watch. But it also could raise gasoline prices, a touchy subject for the president right now.
And we're concerned that the White House has gotten cold feet, that the White House literally is too scared to do the right thing here.
And automakers fear they'll be expected to meet stricter clean car standards without the help of cleaner gasoline. That puts an undue burden on the auto industry, says Gloria Berquist of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers.
First of all, it means that automakers would bear the cost of putting more technology on vehicles. And then the worst part is that this technology could be disabled by the fuels that are available today.
Automakers say it's only fair that oil refiners bear some of the costs of getting cleaner cars on the road as well. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Well, it is primary day in Illinois today, and polls indicate Mitt Romney holds a lead over Rick Santorum there. But as the Republican candidates duke it out in state after state, President Obama can spend another day thinking about the general election. So far, he has out-fundraised all the GOP contenders, but the president has had some trouble attracting money from wealthy contributors. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Nearly 1.5 million Americans have contributed to the Obama campaign, some as little as $2. But according to the Washington Post, only 11,000 have given $2,000 or more, and that's less than half the number of big donations to Obama at this point in the last election.
Well, in 2008, Barack Obama promised a banquet, and in the past couple of years, wealthy contributors have learned that they're going to get stuck with a check.
Claremont McKenna College professor Jack Pitney says the Obama administration has alienated his well-heeled supporters.
They see the president making attacks on Wall Street, Democrats talking about tax increases on the wealthy, and potential contributors see that their interests are at stake and could be hurt by the president's reelection.
But there may be another reason big dollars are going elsewhere this year. Jessica Taylor is an election analyst with the Rothenberg Political Report.
We have seen many different venues and outlets for people to give money this campaign cycle than we did 4 years ago. And I think you will see people give to super PACs where there are less limits on how much they can give.
That doesn't explain why more fat cat donors have written checks to Republican frontrunner Mitt Romney than to Barack Obama so far. Bill Schneider with the moderate Democratic think tank Third Way says Obama's wealthy supporters have lost their enthusiasm.
They support what he's done, but they're disappointed that the economic recovery has been so slow. And also, the anger and fear that they felt towards the Bush administration are not, at this point, as intense as they were in 2008, particularly after the financial collapse.
Schneider expects what he calls rich liberals will regain their passion and start giving when they realize Republicans have a shot at winning back both the Senate and the White House this November. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
And as long as we're on the subject of politics, so Jeremy, what do you think Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney has in common with French President Nicolas Sarkozy?
They both like croissant.
Well, that might be true, but also apparently an image problem. That's according to Heather Horn in her article for TheAtlantic.com. She joins us now. Heather, hello.
Thank you for having me.
So, Heather, you compare Sarkozy and Romney. Describe their similarities.
Well, you want to be careful not to push the comparison too far. What is certainly true is that the men superficially seem to have very few similarities. Romney is known, among other things, for being a family man. And Sarkozy, that is not generally one of the terms that one uses to describe him. What is true, however, is that candidates with wealthy and flamboyant personal lives often have problems relating to voters. And Romney has had a little bit of a problem with that, for example, in the case of saying, well, you know, I don't follow NASCAR personally, but I have friends who own NASCAR teams. Sarkozy's had some problems with that, particularly related to his wife, actually. She said, well, we're very modest people. Now, that probably isn't the thing to say when you are an heiress, rather wealthy model, and it's an election year.
how are the two candidates handling this image problem that they have? Are they handling it in similar ways?
I think it's fair to say that both of these candidates have not been handling these image issues with what would appear to be a cautious approach. Romney has cracked a few jokes, talked about how he himself is unemployed. Sarkozy has been, I wouldn't say it's an approach really of humor, but it certainly is not particularly apologetic. So neither candidate has been apologizing for his personal wealth, that's for sure.
How has the wealth and lifestyles of these candidates affected the way voters see them in France and in the U.S.?
Well, I think the first thing to remember is that the way that voters see candidates is often through the lens offered by the media. And both of these candidates have given the media and the voters something to hang on to by providing some rather bad sound bites from a campaign perspective. Now, of course, there are all kinds of other issues going on in these two different elections, and the electorates are very different. What is true, however, is that this is very much in France, as in the U.S., an election about economic matters.
Heather Horn is the author of an article in The Atlantic on the similarities between Nicolas Sarkozy and Mitt Romney. Heather, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jeremy, are you a downloader of apps on your phone?
Of course, yes.
And free apps, do you download a lot of those?
They're my favorite kind.
Well, apparently they're not necessarily entirely free. A new study from Purdue University found that only about a quarter of the energy a free app uses goes to the app's game or service or whatever it is. The rest goes to collecting information about you and tracking your data.
You know, Stacey, somebody once told me that if you're getting something on the internet for free, you're not the customer, you're the product.
Well, that's very smart. And I don't know, I have a theory that maybe that is why the angry birds are so angry.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner will testify on Capitol Hill today about the European debt crisis. In his prepared remarks, Geithner is urging European countries to avoid draconian budget cuts that could make matters worse for the global economy. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us now from London to discuss. Good morning.
Hello, Jeremy.
So how are Europeans likely to react to this warning from the Treasury Secretary?
This won't go down well in Germany, which is the main supporter of austerity, and it won't go down well probably with the European Commission, which is handling the crisis. But it will very probably raise a cheer in other parts of the Eurozone, where increasingly people agree with Geithner. They are questioning the whole approach of cutting budgets quite savagely while the economy is in a weak and fragile state. Here's Marcel Alexandrovich of Jefferies International Bank.
People looked at Greece and looked at how policy was handled there, and a lot of the European countries are simply not impressed. They're basically saying that Greece was pushed into too much tightening too quickly, and look where that got us.
The Greek economy is still shrinking fast and has a 21% unemployment rate.
Well, are there any countries, Stephen, that are doing what Geithner wants, that are not making these serious draconian cuts?
To a degree, yes. I mean, the Spanish government has just openly defied the European Commission and said, we're not cutting our budget as much as you want. It'll be bad for our economy. And the Dutch, of all people, who are famous for their fiscal discipline, they're having a particularly ferocious debate about austerity right now. So, yes, Geithner's remarks will cause some irritation in Europe, but they'll also receive quite a bit of support.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
Asian markets were mostly down today, that largely due to China's decision to raise the price of gas by up to 7%. Investors are worried higher fuel prices will mean even slower growth for an economy that isn't growing as rapidly as it used to. Marketplace China correspondent Rob Schmitz has that story.
In China, the government sets the price of oil. Energy companies have to pay market prices for crude, but often have to sell at a loss. The government compensates them with subsidies, and those subsidies come directly from the pockets of the people through taxes. Peking University economist Michael Pettis says pricier gas will help tackle China's growing wealth gap.
Those who have cars are going to be negatively impacted, but there you can also think of it as a transfer thing. The ones who have cars tend to be wealthier. So it has a double impact. It reduces the hidden tax on the household sector, and it has a wealth transfer effect from people with cars to people without cars.
But pricier gas will affect everything that's bought or sold. So won't that mean higher inflation? Pettis says yes. But because China's inflation rate has slowed this year, he thinks the impact will be minimal. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, where do you think you see the most ads these days? TV, computer?
I see a mix. I see probably not newspaper because I'm usually reading newspaper websites, but I would say probably the internet.
Yeah, me too, I think. Well, a lot of TV advertisers are also running ads online that you and I see a lot of, apparently. But it's hard to know who sees which ads where. Hmm. So now the ratings company Nielsen is launching a service that will shed some light on that. And Jennifer Collins has that story.
Online and TV ratings have long been available separately. But Tim Calkins, a marketing professor at Northwestern University, says advertisers want to know where their ad campaigns overlap. Take Danone yogurt, for instance.
You know, their challenge is that they're trying to reach a lot of people very quickly because they're in a big fight right now with Chobani and a lot of the new upstart Greek yogurts.
Nielsen's new service could help Danone determine if the same people who see its ads online see them on TV, or if the campaign is in fact expanding Danone's reach. Nielsen says it's tracking online and TV viewership in 15,000 households. Mark Lieberman is the CEO of TRA, another media tracking firm.
This is definitely a step in the right direction. There's no doubt it's something the industry wants and needs.
He says Nielsen's service could help advertisers figure out how to divide up their marketing budgets to reach the biggest audience. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
It appears becoming a lawyer is not as popular as it once was. The number of people taking the LSAT, that's law school's version of an entrance exam, is down 16% this past year, and it's at a 12-year low. Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
Analysts say more people are rethinking whether law school is a good use of, well, $100,000. That's how much debt the average law student takes on. One reason, job market.
There's been a lot of discussion about the big firms reducing in size. Some of them have closed.
Wendy Margolis is with the organization that administers the LSAT. It's not just the big-name law firms. Government budgets are tight, too.
So some of the public law jobs are not as available as they once were.
There have also been exposés of law schools exaggerating job prospects, souring the picture for potential lawyers. So we could end up with fewer of them. Even the deputy dean at Penn Law School, Tom Baker, is okay with that.
The world's going to do just fine because I hope some schools figure out how to turn out lawyers at a lower cost so that there's more lawyers available for ordinary people.
At which point more students may find law school worth the money. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And finally, to Orleans, Massachusetts, where, Stacey, there's a guy named Jacob Clark who got called up for jury duty, but okay. He says he will not go.
Oh, you can't do that.
You can if you're 9 years old, which he is.
Apparently,
God. Somebody had entered his birth year as 1982 instead of 2002. And when asked for a response by the Cape Cod Times, Jacob said, quote, "I was like, what's a jury duty?" End
quote. I'm going to try to use that the next time
I get
called.
Yeah, see if that works for you. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith in New York, and this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.